Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Steve Nesbitt, an ornithologist and retired Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, or FWC, wildlife biologist. He works in that capacity for the FWC for some 35 years, cultivating a reputation for extensive knowledge about a slew of species, and during that time publishing more than 200 scientific papers about assorted fauna, especially birds. Indeed, Nesbitt is particularly recognized for his deep expertise about bald eagles, brown pelicans, whooping cranes, and the chief focus of our conversation today, sandhill cranes. We'll dive into the realm of sandhill cranes, addressing topics from the minor misconception that they mate for life to the way changing habitats in Florida are altering the sandhill crane population here. Over the years, Nesbitt has received a number of accolades, including being named Wildlife Biologist of the Year, and this Talking Animals conversation will likely reflect why, even now, many years after retiring, he's an in-demand speaker. We'll step into that conversation with Steve Nesbitt in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. First, a programming note, in a sense. The great singer-songwriter Kathleen Edwards, also a longtime dog rescuer, will be performing this Saturday, January 25th, at Bayboro Brewing in St. Pete. She's been a guest on Talking Animals a couple of times over the years, including an in-studio appearance here at WMNF, where we discuss music, dogs, her shift to living part-time in St. Pete, and more. And she played a few songs right here in the studio, which is tremendous. So I'm obviously a big fan of Kathleen, looking forward to seeing her Saturday at Bayboro Brewing. Meanwhile, coming up later in today's program, I'll speak with Fred Metzler, owner of the Dog Bar in St. Petersburg, essentially a dog park with a full bar, which often ranges to serve food. And this is in advance of its Barks of the Bay event, set to take place this Friday, January 24th, at the Dog Bar, running from 8 p.m. to midnight, perhaps highlighted by the dogs dressed in pirate gear for the costume Paw Raid. Yeah, you heard me, Paw Raid. We'll find out more about Barks of the Bay when I chat with Fred Metzler later in the show right here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Right now, let's talk with Steve Nesbitt about his decades as a FWC wildlife biologist, guiding us through an exploration of the world of sandhill cranes and more. With a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Steve Nesbitt to Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals.
You're certainly welcome.
So when it comes to animals and nature, I kind of like to, before we get into discussing sandhill cranes, kind of trace a little bit of your history towards becoming a wildlife biologist. So when you were a kid, what kind of role did animals and nature play?
Well, I was always interested in birds. My grandfather was an ornithologist, and he took me with him on several, you know, field trips and out looking at birds. He was a bird watcher back when it was not as popular as it is today. So he introduced me to the whole realm of birds and bird biology at an early age.
And you just sort of took his interest as yours and sort of ran with it.
Yes, exactly.
And what did you like so much as a kid about birds? I mean, obviously partly that it was his passion, but what did you like so much about it as a youngster?
Well, you know, they're around us everywhere. They're an obvious part of our experience, our environment. And, you know, they're beautiful. They're just beautiful.
Spoken like a true birder. No, that's great. I always like to ask people that are birders, either professionally or informally or otherwise, because there's sort of a passion that you don't find necessarily in other fans of animals of one kind or another. It's kind of a singular passion. So I'm always interested in exploring that with people that are birders, much less the way you've done it. So as part of your grandfather's interest, and which became your interest, were there a lot of ventures out into, nature and camping and those kinds of things?
Yeah, pretty much. And you know, back when I was a kid, a big part of it was hunting. I enjoyed hunting, and it's still a part of the experience of having close contact with a wild animal. That's all part of it.
Yeah, I'm sure there's probably, and I guess fishing probably figures into that as well, or?
Yeah, we fished. We fished. He taught me to fish, too.
Yeah, but it sounds like that's more past tense than current.
Yeah, I don't care to do that anymore. I'm more interested in looking at them and watching what they do and how they go about doing it.
And how did that, I'd be interested to know how that evolved, because I think a lot of times people that are into nature, some aspect of it, whether they're birders or otherwise just enjoy communing with nature, are often hunters as well. And then sometimes, like it sounds like in your case, there's some sort of reckoning that happens where they say, well, this isn't for me. I want to see them. I want to be next to them. I want to photograph them or at least see them through binoculars, but I don't want to do anything more than that. Was there a pivotal moment for you in that way? Or
I think it just became gradually more interesting to observe them than it was to actually kill one and hold it. Although there's something to be said for, you know, that kind of proximity right there in front of you. And, you know, it's a remarkable thing to be able to be that close to a wild animal, dead or alive.
So sounds like the people that are interested in hunting in the way that you were previously, at least, it's as much about what kind of distance or proximity you can get to that animal that you can't be really afforded any other way. It's less about, I guess, necessarily killing the animal as like there's no other way to get that close, I guess, safely.
Right. Now, that was the thing that happened for me when I started working for the commission. We captured a lot of animals, particularly cranes and several other species. But you get that intimacy through that, and you release the bird. It's like catch and release fishing. You've had the experience and you've actually turned that animal back into, you know, back into the wild so it can go on about its business. So that satisfied a lot of that curiosity. You know, what do they look like right in front of you? What do they look like up close? How does this work? How does that work?
Yeah.
So that gets satisfied by the actual experience of handling a wild animal and then returning it back into the wild.
Yeah.
But that's pretty much, you know, the professional aspect of it.
Yeah, I guess if you're just doing it as a side passion or a hobby or an outing, you don't necessarily feel bound by those kinds of...
Yeah.
Interesting.
You really can't do that as an amateur. You can't do that unless you're a professional, because handling animals requires permits. So...
Right, because I guess once you handle it, if you don't know what you're doing or you're not properly trained or equipped, then that animal might as well have been killed probably because...
That's right, exactly, yeah. Exactly. You're exactly right. And, you know, it's a, you know, they're, what birds, all, almost all the birds in the United States are protected in one form or another by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and other laws that affect rare and endangered species, things like that. So... they're very careful about who's given permission to, you know, deal with these things on a capture and release basis. So it requires training and proven expertise.
Yeah. Well, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Steve Nesbitt, retired wildlife biologist, having worked some 35 years for the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, or FWC, and long recognized for his deep expertise about a number of birds, including bald eagles, brown pelicans, whooping cranes, and probably the chief focus of today's conversation, the sandhill crane. But if you have a question for Steve or would like to offer a comment about sandhill cranes or other birds, please call 813-239-9663. DJ, you can email DJ at WMF.org or text 813-433-0885. So guide me through how the interest and passion you developed through your grandfather's kind of passion led you to working for the FWC. Was it just sort of like, hey, if I can make a job out of this, this the kind of passion that I have already as a kid, this is the greatest thing going.
Yeah, that's exactly what, you know, you can actually take that interest, passion, whatever, and turn it into a profession. You know, that's the best of both worlds right there.
For sure. So early on, when you first got hired by the FWC, what kind of work were you doing? Were you hired as a wildlife biologist at the get-go, or was there some other capacity?
I went through a master's program, got a master's degree in wildlife ecology. And right away, when I was hired as a wildlife biologist. Then I started working with, first job was surveying brown pelican colonies in Florida, and then nesting bald eagles. But all along, the commission, even before I got here, was working on sandhill cranes as a sort of a adjunct to a different project. They were catching them incidentally to capturing wild turkeys, and while they were doing that and they had them in hand, they went ahead and banded some and marked them as individuals and then followed their, you know, behavior after they were released. So I started participating in some of that too, but that was more of a, you know, incidental thing.
Yeah.
But then when the opportunity came along to consider reintroducing a pooping crane, then the Florida sandhill crane, our resident non-migratory crane, became an important part of the project with pooping crane, because sandhill cranes, being the most numerous crane in the world, are actually the functional guinea pig for crane research anywhere.
So just because they're so plentiful, or what makes them the guinea pig?
Yeah, because they are so plentiful, and if you accidentally kill one, it's not a tragedy. If you accidentally killed a hooping crane, that would be a major tragedy, because back in the days when we started the project, the population was, you know, extremely low, less than 100 individuals, so in the wild.
Wow.
So if you lost one of those birds, that becomes a critical loss to the population. You know, the loss of any individual is not something you strive for. You don't want that to happen, but if it has to happen, let it happen to one that's not going to affect the, you know, worldwide population.
You got a numerical cushion, it sounds like, of sorts.
Right, exactly.
Okay, well, I'm going to continue this conversation, but it looks like we have a caller who'd like to get in on the conversation, so let's include them. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Steve Nesbitt. Hello, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, great. You have a question or a comment for Steve Nesbitt?
Yes. It's a two-part question. One, I've been scratching my head, but how long can a bird survive without flying?
Well, it depends on, you know, how they get food. If they can get food without flying, they can survive quite a while. But if they're required to fly like an eagle or a raptor that has to capture its prey, if they can't fly, they're pretty much doomed.
Like a, I don't know if they're a crow or a raven around here, Spring Hill.
Mm-hmm. It depends. If they've got a good source of food, they can survive for a while, but not, you know, they're certainly not going to be able to reproduce. So they're functionally not part of the population after that.
Yeah, I guess it was around the first storm that I guess it got blown into a tree and it injured its wing.
You're talking about a crow?
Yeah, but we call it the Black Walker.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, he sure can't walk fast.
Yeah, they're good at that. What is it? You know what he's eating? What he's getting for?
I guess, you know, one of the neighbors, you know, has like cracked corn and and puts water out, and then my other neighbor's got seed out, and yeah, I'm just wondering, because it's been quite a while. It's been probably 4 months or so.
Really?
Maybe longer. Yeah.
That's pretty good. As long as he's got food and, water, he can survive like that. The problem
I think
be,
it's cool. Nature, you know, they constantly make lemonade out of lemons, you know?
Yeah, right.
Okay, well, my second part is there an organization, because last year or so, there was a crane that had, I guess, a club foot, and it kept getting to where he was walking on, like, bone.
Yeah.
And I know it had to hurt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we would feed him all the time. We call him Big Bird. And one day we saw him down sitting at the tree, and he wasn't getting up. You know, he could fly, you know, he could take off, but I know landing is like a pulled tooth, you know.
Yeah.
All right, Steve, do you have a comment? We're going to probably keep moving here because we got other callers, other emails, but I appreciate your question. Let's give Steve a chance to answer that, and then we'll keep moving.
Okay.
Thank you.
The loss of the foot or the lower leg in a crane is not that uncommon. We've seen several that have lost part of one leg. One time there was one that lost parts of both legs. And they can survive for a while like that. But again, they're not going to be able to reproduce, so they become a non-functional part of the population.
Because they have a bum foot, and that affects their mobility, they don't mate, or they don't have a chance to mate?
And their appeal as a mate is gone.
Oh, I see.
So the whole point of mating is to reproduce. And in order to reproduce, they have to be able to protect the territory, and they also have to be able to feed their chicks until the chicks are able to feed themselves. So if you're a female and your mate got a bum foot and he can't move around as well as he needs to get groceries, you're going to find somebody else.
Yeah, it's a cruel world, but I guess I understand what her decision would be. Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Okay, so here's another email that came in sort of diet-related, maybe on the heels of the initial question. We got the subject line says Sandhill Crane's diet, and then it says, in your experience, will they eat small mammals like squirrels, kittens, rats? If so, how do they consume them, whole?
I've never seen one eat anything bigger than maybe a like a rat. They would. I think a squirrel's going to be too big. Certainly kittens are going to be too big. They will eat small rodents, and they'll eat baby birds. They will eat birds out of the nest. They will eat bird eggs. So they're pretty omnivorous.
Yeah.
This time of year, they're principally eating, grains, seeds, roots, tubers, things like that. And then in the spring, they start going more toward insects. And insects are a big part of the diet when they're feeding the young. And then they will, move on to bigger things once the young can handle it. I have ever seen them, if they catch a bird that's too big to feed to the chicks, they can actually take it apart, tear it apart, and feed pieces of it to the chicks.
Wow.
So they can do that, but, they're not really adept at catching birds per se. They can catch flightless young birds, and that's about it.
I see. Okay, great. Well, let's take another caller here while we're on a bit of a roll. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Steve Nesbitt.
Hi, Duncan. Hi, Steve, Mr. Nesbitt. My question to you is, first a comment that I went to the Mott Bird Sanctuary for the first time in Sarasota near Lido Beach. Have you ever been there?
No.
Well, there's sandhill cranes there, and I saw them for the first time. But it is the most pristine bird sanctuary that I've ever seen. It's not very big, but the sand, there's no bird poop or anything. I mean, it's just so clean. It's remarkable what a great job that they do there. It's almost like a Zen garden, where they have the sand so curated. I'm sorry. Go ahead and make your comment.
I was just going to say that sounds exciting.
It is. I encourage you to go see this, if you have time while you're here. But my question to you is that while I was there, there were some birds that are like the white bird that's on Beretta. It's a cockatoo or something.
That sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I started singing the song "Kookaburra Sits in the Old Gum Tree, Mary Mary King of the Woodland Tea." And
yeah.
The bird got up on the ceiling and hung upside down. And the lady next to me said that that's because he was listening to me. Is that true?
Yeah.
They hang upside down when they're listening?
I would not know that. I don't know that much about parrots. But it also could be just he's curious,
Curious. Okay. Well, yeah. But then he said hello. So I was really surprised that, he was listening or participating in the conversation.
Sure.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome, Duncan, and thank you.
Okay. So, Steve, we kind of delved into sandhill cranes by comments and questions and stuff. So let's keep going. Can you describe your reaction the first time you saw a sandhill crane?
Well, let's see. The first time I saw one, probably he was flying, and they're big birds.
Yeah.
They're 4 or 5 feet tall, depending on which subspecies they are. And they're impressive. And the thing that impressed me the most about them as I got to know them is how complex their behaviors are, how complex their interactions with each other are. It's not random. Everything they do has a purpose. And once you start learning about it and figuring out what this means, what that means, it's a very, very fascinating part of nature.
Can you give me an example or two of something that one of us somebody that doesn't have the kind of expertise that you do might see a sandhill crane do or a pair of them do and not know that it means XYZ the way that that it means
You're right. And they, when you see them together, especially our local population, the Florida sandhill cranes, which are not non-migratory, so they live year-round in the same general area, they all know each other. They know each other by status. They know each other by individuals. And when two pairs come together and you see an interaction, you'll notice that the dominant pair will approach the other pair, and you'll hear a what they call a guard call, a loud call that both the pair gives together, male and the female give the call together, and they'll drop their head, show their crown, the red crown, which is a signaling mechanism, and the pair that's being subordinate will turn around and walk away. So they can get rid of these intruders without any kind of, you know, aggression.
Confrontation.
Any kind of confrontation. So they save themselves from potential injury by just being dominant and showing their dominance by, again, showing that red head. If you didn't know what that meant, you just think, you know, hey, there's two birds or four birds interacting together, and that's all you'd notice.
And now there's two instead of the four because two walked away, but you wouldn't know, like, why the two walked away.
Right, exactly.
And the dominant ones are doing that, I guess, what, just because, hey, there's food in the area and we don't want to be competing?
It's the territory.
Yeah.
It's protecting their territory.
Okay.
And the territory is integral to their ability to reproduce because, like I said, when the chicks first come out, they're pretty helpless. So they have to be fed for at least a month or so after they hatch by the parents, and the parents are dependent on that territory to provide the resources that it requires to, you know, nurture those chicks. So if they're sharing that with another pair of birds and their chicks, there may not be enough resources to go around. So they guard that territory pretty heavily.
Yeah.
Especially during the nesting season.
Makes sense. Again, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Steve Nesbitt, a retired wildlife biologist and expert on multiple bird species, including the sandhill crane, the chief focus of today's conversation. If you have any questions or comments about sandhill cranes or other birds, of course, you're invited to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663. Emailing DJ at WMNF.org or texting 813-433-0885. Let's back up a little bit if we could, Steve, and do something that might be called Cranes 101. So maybe that we could just do like a brief global overview, like how many species of crane are there worldwide, for example?
15 species of cranes in the world, and we got two of them in North America, whooping cranes, sandhill cranes.
And one, as you mentioned earlier in a different context, sandhill quite plentiful, even now, I guess, and whooping crane by comparison population is much smaller?
Yes. It's still, they're still under 1,000. But when I first started working, there were less than 100 in the wild. And at one point, the population was down to as few as 15 individuals. So what we have now today came back from, you know, an extremely low number of birds. So what that tells you is, you know, with the right kind of knowledge and the right kind of care, we can preserve some of these species that are still now critically endangered. We can still have them with us.
So what were the measures taken to have the whooping crane population rally from as low as 15 to now, I guess, sounds like back up to about 1,000, give or take?
Yeah. Part of it was captive propagation. They were taken, some of them were taken into captivity. Actually, the eggs were taken into captivity, raised, hatched, and raised in captivity, and used those founder birds to establish a population that were suitable for release into the wild. We released some in Florida. There have been some released in Wisconsin, and now they're releasing some in Louisiana. In addition to that, they started protecting the wild population that nest in Canada and winters in Texas. They started protecting those and making sure they had the resources they needed, especially on the wintering ground in Texas, to sustain the population. And that population has grown dramatically in the last 25 years.
And what kind of steps are taken when you implement protection, as you say, for those kind of...
Knowledge that they're not accidentally shot during hunting season.
Okay.
That's part of it. The other part of it is to, again, maintain the habitat. Migration habitat in Canada and the United States has to be available to them, both spring and fall. They have to have, cranes are dependent on two things, marshes and water, marshes and upland habitat. They have to have equal amounts of both habitats to be able to survive. And so that's what's being preserved by refuges, national parks, things like that.
Okay. Yeah. And they do seem like, well, I live actually on the other coast from where I'm talking to you now, in a kind of rural enclave of Jupiter called Jupiter Farms. And I see sandhill cranes kind of walking around or various places like all the time, it seems like. And is that just because it is maybe a slightly more rural area and so they feel comfortable there and they've got the other criteria that you mentioned that they need to kind of flourish? Or
yeah.
Because I'm surprised when I see them sometimes. That, I mean, they, you know, go to a shopping plaza or something, and there they are just wandering around, and they seem unfazed.
Almost every time you see a bird like that, you know it's a Florida sandhill crane. We have two kinds. We have Florida sandhills. We have the migratory greater sandhills. They both look exactly the same, so you can't tell them apart. But the behaviors are totally different. The wild ones, the migratory ones, are actually much wilder than our birds. Our birds, because they live, like I said, in the territory year-round, they're familiar with surroundings, they're familiar with the area, they can become habituated to humans and human activity.
Yeah, they don't seem phased in the least, some of them.
That's because they haven't been tormented and nobody's bothered them.
Harassed.
And they've adjusted. Yeah, they haven't been harassed, right? They have adjusted to the environment. Now, whether or not that's good for them, that's a different question, aesthetically and maybe ecologically too.
Oh yeah, what would be the downside in that scenario?
Well, hit by cars.
I see. You mean so comfortable that they're not being careful,
right? And also, the young birds, especially before they can fly, are extremely, vulnerable to being killed by dogs and cats.
Mm. Yeah. So I guess just being that comfortable in and amongst sort of population of some kind has its own, I guess, risks that...
Oblivious mankind can be a dangerous thing.
Yeah, in so many regards, for sure. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Steve Nesbitt.
Yeah, this is Lauren Shepherd. I'm really enjoying the show. I appreciate the show every time I listen. I've got a question about sandhill cranes. I'm not sure if this is accurate, that they mate for life, and if they do, what happens when one of the two may, be killed or die off? If it's not true, what does? I know there are other bird species that mate for life, and again, the same question.
That is a good question, and it's a part of the mythology of cranes and a lot of these large, what are called K-selected species. They do mate. I guess it's more appropriate to call them perennially monogamous rather than mate for life. They mate with another crane and they stay together as long as they are reproductively successful. The whole point of it is to reproduce. If one member of the pair dies, the other bird will find another mate rather quickly. In a situation like we have in Florida, where most of the available habitat that's suitable for cranes has already got cranes in it, there are lots of birds out there. It takes about 5 years for a crane to mature to old enough to actually breed. So in that period, in that interim period of time, they're looking for any opportunity they can to find a mate and acquire a territory. So when one pair member dies, they repair rather quickly. One example, we had one pair that we were monitoring, and one of the members died, and the male survived, and he had a new mate by the same afternoon. The female was gone in the morning, and by afternoon, he had a new mate. So if you didn't know those birds as individuals, and you saw that happen, you would think that pair was together, and they may stay on the same territory for 20 or 30 years, but it's not the same individuals that are on that territory. The territory is occupied by cranes, but it's not necessarily the same crane.
Yeah, that's...
Sometimes I see cranes in odd numbers, so three or one, and I get concerned that an offer had an accident or something like that. That might be accurate? Because it seems like they're always together, right? You know, they do everything together. They don't just go off, hey, you go feed over here and I'll go feed over there. They're always together.
Yes, that's correct. But if you see one single bird anytime in for us in Florida, between, say, even maybe mid-December through April or May, that could be an individual that's a member of a pair, and the other member of the pair is on a nest. So we have a fairly long nesting season in Florida, and they will re-nest multiple times. So they could be on eggs, depending on how successful they were, you know, for several months. And the other thing that happens is a lot of the birds that are not paired, the young birds, like I said, this is what we would refer to as sub-adult individuals, and it, like I said, it takes 4 or 5 years for them to become fully mature. And start reproducing. They're in a group called, you know, a subadult group, and there can be anywhere from 7 or 8 of them together like that. Those may be subadult birds. But also, if you see a family group, 3 or 4 birds together, that may be an adult male, adult female, and they're young from that year. The young stay with their parents until they're almost a full year old. So they're together for a year. And after they get to be about 3 or 4 months old, they look pretty much like their parents.
Yeah.
All right, thanks for your call.
One last quick thing. We just had a marvelous situation in our area where they were nesting in a marsh and on some aquatic plant, and we were able to just watch the whole progression of egg to chick to leaving the nest. It was really amazing.
Wow. That's great.
Yeah.
It sounds like you were super lucky.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
All right.
I've never seen him nest otherwise. Thank you, guys.
Thanks for sharing that story. Thanks for your call. Take care. Yeah, so, Steve, I think much like our caller, before I started doing a little homework in preparation for our conversation, I think was also of the mind that sandhill cranes mated for life and okay to be disabused of that notion. It seemed kind of romantic at first before I knew their whole story. But here's the other thing. When I do see them walking around, like I said, kind of near my neck of the woods, I can never really tell the male from the female. Is there a trick? I mean, how can you distinguish them?
Well, the male is usually the bigger of the two birds. That's one way to tell.
Yeah, that's how you would do it in most species, but a lot of times these birds seem very similar in size and appearance.
Especially, especially in our Florida birds, they are very close. The best way to tell is to watch their call. And if you hear them calling, the female voice is higher pitched than the male voice.
Mm.
Regardless of size, the female voice is distinctly higher pitched than the male voice. And if they give what's called the unison call, where they call together simultaneously, they'll do that a lot when they're nesting and when they're in their territorial disputes, they'll do a unison call. The male will throw his head back and it's almost a complete, hold his head almost vertical and will give a long call. And the female will hold her head at a 45 degree angle and give a short call that goes tuck, 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 tuck. So when you see them doing that, there's no question. That's actually the best way to sex the pair.
By the call.
By the call.
Yeah. So again, sort of a running theme of our conversation almost from the get-go is proximity is crucial because you'd have to be close enough, obviously, to hear the call to determine who is doing what.
Yeah, but if you see them calling, like I said, the unison call, there's no question. You can tell that from as far away as you can see them. If they're unison calling, you can tell who the male and who the female is.
Oh, okay. So if a pair of sandhill cranes strolled by you right now, you'd pretty readily identify the male and the female, it sounds like.
If they were making any noise, yeah.
Right.
Size, like you say, size is not always a given.
Yeah. So it sounds like the call is critical.
Yes.
One more time, this is Talking Animals on WNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Steve Nesbitt, retired wildlife biologist, an expert on a number of birds. We've been talking mostly about the sandhill cranes, but he's got expertise in many others. And so in our sort of final few moments here, if you'd like to Join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. You're absolutely invited to do so. Now let's, in fact, take another call right now. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Steve Nesbitt.
Hi, good morning. I have a question. This happened a couple summers ago, and we have a water area behind our house, and I saw a great blue herring that was actually went swimming in the water. It looked like a swan, and I've never seen that before. I didn't know it was hot, so I guess he was trying to cool off, and I found that very interesting.
Yeah, I've never seen a great blue swim, but cranes can swim, and they do look like swans when they're swimming. You are correct.
Okay, I've just never seen that before. I thought it was really interesting. It was actually very pretty. Thanks.
Sounds cool. Thanks for your call. Thanks for sharing that. All right, Steve. So we're sort of in the home stretch of our time here. So one thing I think I touched on, or you did, is habitat change in Florida seems to have affected, you know, obviously all kinds of species. And, of course, in some cases, not surprisingly, it affects their population. What's been the impact in this regard on sandhill cranes?
Well, they are basically, like I said earlier, they're birds of marshes and open habitat.
Yeah.
So the loss of open habitat, basically Florida grasslands, and they will use pastures and you know, grazing habitat, sod farms, agricultural areas, they will use that too. But the loss of those kinds of habitat can impact the population. We've seen a decline in the number of cranes in Florida, Florida cranes, not the migratory ones, the resident ones, based on loss of habitat. So it has happened.
Okay, yeah.
So it has to be maintained, and cranes also need, it has to be managed. They don't like overgrown habitat. It's not good either. So they're basically a bird of prairie country. So, you know, the grasslands of Florida, grasslands in the Midwest where they nest in you know, Canada as well. Some of those are maintained naturally, but ours has to be maintained probably mechanically now.
Yeah. All right, so perhaps our final question for today, at least, is going back to when you were hanging out with your grandfather and getting the passion for birds sort of passed along from him. What are your two or three favorite birds at this point, and why?
For me?
Yeah.
Well, I've always liked ducks. Ducks and water birds in particular.
Mm-hmm.
I've always liked ducks. And I just think ducks are fascinating. I don't know why, but I just do. And I like the habitat they live in. The other things that are of interest to me are warblers. I find warblers fascinating because they're beautiful, and they occur in all throughout the country and in all kinds of different habitats. So no matter where you go, you can always find warblers to look at. And same thing for sparrows; you can find sparrows to look at too. But it's the challenge of identifying, the challenge of understanding who they are and what they're doing, why they're there. It never ceases.
All right. Well, that's probably a pretty good place at which to leave it. And do you have any kind of either social media page or website or any online presence where if people wanted to follow up with a question or a comment or anything, they could reach you that way? Or not really, I don't think.
No.
I didn't find anything. I just thought I would ask.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, no
problem. Well, people that are resourceful will find you like I did. So anyway, yeah. Steve, well, thank you so much. This has been Steve Nesbitt, again, retired FWC wildlife biologist, and we've been talking about sandhill cranes and other birds. Thank you so much for your time, and thanks for the calls. I'm sorry we didn't get to quite all the calls. We got to, I think, the emails and most of the calls, so I appreciate your input. And right now I'm going to say that we'll be speaking shortly with Fred Metzler, owner of the Dog Bar in St. Petersburg, which is gearing up for its Barks of the Bay event happening this Friday, January 24th. There'll be food and drink and dancing to a DJ, a doggy pirate costume, and more. Right now, in fact, we're going to step into the Comedy Corner with a new piece from an old fave, tied in part to our conversation with Steve Nesbitt. Here's Joe Zimmerman with part of a piece called Bird Watching, today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Yeah, so I don't feel old, but I did recently identify a bird. That can't be good. Is that a whippoorwill? Why do I care? And why do I have binoculars? My bird book says it is a whippoorwill. Yes. Got it. Good thing I've been studying. Yeah, I got into birding over the pandemic. I went down to Central Park. At first, I did it ironically. I was like, I'm so stupid. Got too much time. 2 hours later, I'm like, Martha, look at that owl. She's like, that's a robin. I'm like, I'm new. But that is beautiful. And I actually met a professional bird watcher. He goes birding tours. I said, that sounds like a fun job. And he goes, well, you get a lot of egos. In bird watching? And he told me guys will brag about how many birds they've seen. And the best part is how they verify they've seen a bird is they just say that they did. It's an honor code, so I've seen every bird. Prove I haven't. Oh, yeah, where'd you see the cinnamon-breasted toady tyrant? Denver. They only live in Tasmania. Yeah, I was surprised. I was like, weird, here? Check. But then I realized you could have more fun with an arrogant birder if you went too low with your number. They're all bragging. You're just like, that's cool. I've only seen two birds. Well, you've seen more than two birds. I wish. It's just been pigeons and crows for me. How long have you been birding? 4 years. So bad at it.
That was Joe Zimmerman in today's Comedy Corner, the part of a piece called Birdwatching, taken from a performance at the Comedy Works in Denver. Now it's time to speak with Fred Metzler, who owns the Dog Bar in St. Pete, just 2 days away from its Barks of the Bay event extravaganza coming up. Here's Fred Metzler on Talking Animals on WNF. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals. I appreciate the talking animal in the background. That's perfect.
Yeah, that was Bruce. He owns the bar.
Okay.
No, out of the room. Okay.
No, I hope he wasn't sent away on my account. We love talking animals here. Bruce sounds like a very articulate spokesman.
He has a lot to say. He really does, yeah.
I'm sure. So for those who haven't had the pleasure of visiting just yet, can you describe the Dog Bar? Where is it? What is it? And how does it work?
We're in St. Petersburg on Central Avenue, 2300 Central. Essentially, we are a private dog park with a full bar. People bring their dogs. We have about a 4,500 square foot off-leash area where the dogs get to play. All the dogs that come in do have to be vetted. Everyone's got to be up to date on shots. They've got to be fixed if they're more than a year old. And, of course, non-aggressive. So, essentially, it's a great social location for both the dogs and the people. We have a good time doing it.
And it sounds like there's a lot of events there.
We try to do events almost every weekend. Essentially, our events are usually slated around local rescues, and the whole object of the events is to drive some money to the smaller rescues.
Yeah.
It's kind of become our mission statement, but again, it's fun for everybody, and it's good for us as well.
That's cool. Well, with that in mind, tell me about Barks of the Bay.
Okay, well, Barks of the Bay is essentially going to be a pirate party, if you will, party for the puppies. It's not necessarily a costume, but it is it's a costume day. It's basically a dress-up day. Not a contest, but everyone who shows up with their dog in costume will get a little, essentially like a Happy Meal box full of treats and a toy or two and some fun. We have a good time with it. We really do. And it'll all be to raise money for Safe Paws Rescue, which is one of our favorite small rescues in the area. And it starts at 8 o'clock on Friday night. Should be fun.
That's great. So there's the costume part of it, dressing as pirates. And there's music, I understand, I believe. And
Yes. We will have a DJ. We always... We call it Bark After Dark on Friday nights.
Okay.
So we always have a DJ.
And there's food, it sounds like, available.
There will be a food truck. Right off the top of my head, I'm not sure who it is, but we have a great lineup of food trucks. Stephanie takes care of that, and we have some of the best in the city, actually.
That's great. So do people just show up if they're interested, or do you have to make any kind of reservations or arrangements in advance?
No reservation needed. If you haven't been there before, you can register your dog online, which will save some time. Even download your shot records so that you won't have to do anything but check in once you get there.
That sounds great.
Yeah, it makes it a little bit easier, it does.
And can you come dogless? Let's say that somebody's like between dogs, just doesn't have a dog at the moment, but would like to be around some dogs and thinks this party sounds fun.
Over 30% of the people who come into our bar come in without a dog.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing I always caution, you better like dogs. If you don't care for dogs, then we're not your bar.
Yeah.
But one of the things we've said for a long time, if you don't have a dog because, fill in the blank, if you can't give that dog a great life, then you're a great dog owner. You just don't have one right now.
There you go.
And there are always puppies that are looking for people to pet them. That's just kind of how some of them are. That's their personality.
Sure. Well, it sounds like this is going to be a great event for people with their dogs, people that don't currently have dogs, and others, I guess, too. So that's this Friday.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but in a couple of weeks, we have our Wolf Ball Puppy Bowl, which we do a live puppy bowl on Super Bowl Sunday.
Great.
Just have to throw that out there. It's a great time. It's from 4:30 to 6:30 before the game.
That sounds awesome. Well, Fred, this all sounds great. We'll look forward to Barks by the Bay next this coming Friday, just 2 days from now. And it sounds like it's going to be a blast. Thank you so much for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Have a good day.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
So coming up on WNF, it's The Conversation, the great show hosted by Mario Nunez and Joe King Carter. After that, we shift back to music programming with Jim Bannon holding forth from 1 to 3, followed by Nancy C hosting the Wednesday Traffic Jam from 3 to 6 p.m., at which point our terrific Wednesday night Bach Latin music kicks in. So, and next week, my guest will be Hannah Shaw, an award-winning kitten rescuer, humane educator, and New York Times bestselling author. Her latest offering is Cats of the World, a collaboration between Shaw and her husband, noted photographer Andrew Martello, in which they travel to 30 countries reporting on cat rescue, feline welfare, and other aspects of kitty culture they found in each locale, while Martello captures the scenes with an array of gorgeous photography. So that's next Wednesday here on Talking Animals, Wednesday, January 29th. With Hannah Shaw on Talking Animals on WNF. Okay, I'm going to try to squeeze in at least some of Kathleen Edwards, who I mentioned at the top of the show. And so this is Talking Animals on WNF Tampa. And this is Kathleen Edwards, who will be, again, at Bayboro Brewing this Saturday. Great show. Great fan here of Talking Animals and more broadly from WNF. This is Kathleen Edwards with a dog song.
I picked you up on the other side of the river. Dogs and alcohol, they go so good together. You were so sweet, immediately charm me with your skin and bones. Hop in the back seat. Here we go. Keep up with you.
As Kathy Edwards here on Talking Animals on WNF, she'll be holding forth once again at Bayboro Brewing this Saturday in St. Pete, and she's a part-time St. Pete resident, no less, so it's going to be great. This is Talking Animals on WNF Tampa. Stay tuned for NPR News headlines and the conversation after that, and Jim Bannon after that. Thanks.